Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Stephen Falk, City Manager of Lafayette and your moderator for tonight's program. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest, Ralph Richard Banks, author of the new book, Is Marriage for White People? How the African-American Marriage Decline Affects Everyone. Ralph Richard Banks is the Jackson Eli Reynolds Professor of Law at Stanford Law School, where he teaches equal protection law, family law, employment discrimination law, and race and the law. Professor Banks is an expert on race and inequality, and his research on these issues spans a variety of domains from criminal justice to employment to the family. Prior to joining the law school, he practiced law at O'Melveny & Myers, was the Reginald F. Lewis Fellow at Harvard Law School, and clerked for a federal judge, the Honorable Barrington Parker, Jr. His writings have appeared in a wide range of popular and scholarly publications, including the Stanford Law Review, the Yale Law Review, the New York Times, and the Los Angeles Times. He has appeared in and been quoted by major media outlets, including ABC News Nightline, National Public Radio, The New York Times, The Los Angeles Times, KQED Forum with Michael Krasny, and many others. Please welcome Professor Ralph Richard Banks.
So after that introduction, I suddenly feel older here. Since there is a gavel, I guess I should start by talking about the law. Since I come from a law school, when Sandra Day O'Connor, first woman to be a Supreme Court justice, graduated from Stanford Law School in the mid-1950s, she was unable to find a job. When I tell students this, sometimes they cannot believe it, but she had graduated at the very top of her class, yet was unable to find a job as a lawyer, and was very quickly relegated to a position as a secretary. For others, given a desk in the corner, a small amount of space. From there, she worked her way up. At the time when she graduated, of course, there were no women in major law firms. There were very few women lawyers. There were very few women in law school. She was one of only a few women at Stanford Law School. And Stanford Law School, I should add, and I'm not biased in this respect at all, was ahead of the curve, right? There were more women at Stanford Law School than there were at other law schools in the 1950s. At that time, most women who married did so to obtain economic support. Most women were not in the labor force. Even if the women were educated, the jobs weren't available. Marriage was one means of ensuring that the women would have support. There were other factors that channeled women and men into marriage as well. In the 1950s, when Sandra Day O'Connor graduated, had she decided that she wanted to perhaps move in with her boyfriend? They might well be in violation of the law. In many states, it was actually illegal to live together, to have sex without being married. It was a criminal offense. At this time, of course, the Supreme Court had yet to issue its landmark rulings that guaranteed that birth control would be at least legally available. The Supreme Court had not yet decided Roe v. Wade, making abortion legally available. So women and men married in part because marriage was the only way for women in particular to obtain economic support, but for men and women together to enter into the sorts of relationships that people tend to enter into when they're adults, loving, intimate sexual relationships. Marriage was thus a starting line in the race of life. It was something that one did early. It was a marker of being an adult. And after marriage, other things came. Children, buying a house. Those were things that came later. Now, of course, the world in which Sandra Day O'Connor came of age seems a distant memory. All the rules that we had to channel people into marriage have been relaxed. It's no longer illegal to have sex without being married, for those of you who are wondering. It's permissible now to live together without being married. Birth control and abortion are available, which allows people to control their reproductive lives. So marriage has gone from being marriage is no longer a necessity as a matter of legal rules. It's also no longer a necessity in terms of economic need. At Stanford Law School and many similar law schools now, women are, if not half of the class, a majority of the class. Women have advanced economically in ways that might have seemed unimaginable in 1950. There are more women who graduate from college now than there are men. That was true last year. It will be true this year. It'll be true the year after that. Women have eclipsed men, at least in terms of college graduation, in terms of their educational achievements. This development with women moving ahead of men educationally comes at the same time that high-level educational skills, college education and the advanced skills that come with it, are worth more economically than ever. So women are getting more education at the same time that education has become worth more. The position of men, on the other hand, has deteriorated somewhat over the last several decades. At the time that Justice O'Connor graduated from Stanford Law School again, not only did men dominate law school and similar educational arenas, even men who did not go to college did pretty well economically. In my own family, who I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, I had lots of relatives who did not go to college. They were blue-collar workers, and they earned more than enough money to support their families because they worked at steel mills and they worked in auto plants. They had unionized blue-collar jobs that paid very well. Now it's no surprise to hear that those jobs don't exist. The one cousin I had who was holding on, who I saw this just this week, who had been holding on to his job at Ford Motor Company for decades, finally relinquished that and became a nurse. He realized correctly that there was more possibility for economic security in nursing than there was in working at the auto plant. So at the same time that women have moved ahead educationally, and moved ahead professionally, men have fallen behind. Men have lagged now. Men lag now in college graduation, and the jobs that blue-collar workers would have enjoyed and would have been able to build a life around decades ago either pay less or don't exist. Many of them, as we know, have moved overseas. So these are the background factors that set the stage for my inquiry in this book. Right? How have the cultural shifts that we see with all the rules that once channeled people into marriage but no longer do, and how have the economic shifts, the increasing value of education, the demise of blue-collar jobs held by men, the fact that women have moved ahead, how have those economic shifts changed the terrain of marriage? These are monumentally important developments, and they are reflected in the family lives that people lead. There are two major consequences of these developments. One is that people are less likely to marry. Used to be people married young, now they marry later. People, the average age of marriage is at an all-time high, and we have some number of people who may never marry at all. People, women in their 30s or men in their 30s, say, are more likely now to be unmarried than ever. So we have more unmarried people in the society. The married couple that was once the norm is no longer. Married couples with children, that model that we have in our minds, are statistically becoming a minority. That's one change. The other change has to do with the situation in those marriages that do form. When men and women marry, and I talk mostly about men and women, when men and women marry, the wife is more likely than ever to earn more and or be better educated than her husband. And this is unsurprising. It's also unprecedented. In 1970 or so, just a few percent of women earn more than their husband. Just 2 or 3%. Now, it's 1 in 4. 1 in 4 wives earns more than her husband. This is obviously a reflection of the fact that wives are moving ahead educationally. Education is becoming worth more economically. If women maintain their educational advantage, this economic trend will accelerate, or the economic advantage of wives will continue to accumulate or grow. And both of these are unprecedented shifts, both the marriage decline and the changing economic positions of spouses. So the centerpiece of my book is to kind of examine these and to figure out what the consequences of these changes are, how to assess these changes, what they mean for American society. And the way I decided to do that was, in fact, to look at the experiences of African Americans. Because these changes, the marriage decline and the change in economic positions of spouses, are most pronounced among African Americans. Right? Sometimes in our public debate, we think of the experiences of African Americans as distinct from those experiences of everyone else. Right? And this is reflected in the literature about marriage. And this is what one of the things that frustrated me was that when you look at the literature about marriage, and I teach this every year, you'd find that there are a lot of books written about marriage in American society, but in virtually none of those books do they devote much attention to African Americans. They mention on page 158 in a footnote, oh, well, there's something going on with African Americans as well. But the sense is that if you want to understand what's happening in the society, you need to look at the, quote, mainstream. And the mainstream means mostly white Americans, because that's the largest group in the society. The books that are written about African Americans, in turn, weren't written about all African Americans. They were typically written about very, very poor African Americans. People in inner cities, the so-called underclass. And the assumption there was that there's something peculiar going on with the underclass. There's something different going on with the underclass. Perhaps it's deviant, but it doesn't tell us anything about American society. But in this book, I wanted to counter both of those tendencies to talk about marriage. I wanted to write about the issues with the African-American family in a way that highlighted the universality of the black experience. In other words, if you want to understand how marriage is changing, if you want a perspective on the marriage decline and on the changing economic positions of husbands and wives, there is no better place to look than the lives of African Americans. Because we see there, among a vulnerable group, the most stark expression of trends that before long will envelop all of society. We see in a more pronounced form among African Americans the same developments that we see throughout the society. So marriage has declined among whites, but it's declined the most among African Americans. 70% of black women, for example, are unmarried. This is of adults, which makes black women the most unmarried group in the nation. It's also true that a majority of black men are unmarried. About 60% of black men are unmarried, which makes black men the most unmarried group of men in the nation. The marriage decline began earlier among African Americans, and marriage has also declined more among African Americans. There are other developments that are associated with the marriage decline, which also show that trends in the society in general often follow the experiences of African Americans. The most salient one is unwed childbearing. In the 1960s, Daniel Patrick Moynihan termed single-parent black families a tangle of pathology. This is in the so-called Moynihan Report, The Negro Family, The Case for National Action. He highlighted what then seemed an outrage, that 25%, or actually slightly less than 25%, of black children were born to unmarried parents. Now, of course, more than 25% of children are born to unmarried parents among whites. More than 25% of white children are born to unmarried parents. Nationwide, 40% of children are born to unmarried parents. Among African Americans, the figures are still higher. 70% of children are born to unmarried parents. A striking figure. But again, trends among whites follow the trends among African Americans. Whites are more likely now to have a child without being married than African Americans were in 1965 when Moynihan created such an uproar by bringing attention to that fact. And if we look at young white women, these are women in their early 20s who have their first child at that time. So women between 20 and 24, 60% of those women are not married when they have that first child. This is among whites. 60% of them are not married when they have that first child. An extraordinary statistic. So the marriage decline is most apparent among African Americans, but it extends to all groups. So too has the economic position of husband and wives changed the most among African Americans. One of the startling statistics that I came across is that when you look at college-educated black women, more than half of them who are married to a man who is less educated or lower earning than they are. Simple way to think about it is that among professional black women who are married, a majority of them have blue-collar husbands. Monumentally important shift, especially given the changing value of education in the labor market. This development is unsurprising from one perspective, because although men have surpassed women educationally and professionally generally, or are surpassing them, the gender gap is widest among African Americans. Another sobering statistic, a striking one, is that among African Americans, when you look at college graduates now, not all the people who've ever graduated from college, but when you look at recent college graduates, you see that women are graduating college twice as frequently as men. That is to say, every year, or last year, twice as many African-American women as men graduated from college. This year, twice as many African-American women as men will graduate from college. These are big gender gaps. But things get worse for African-Americans because the pool of men is not only the paucity of men in the pool of marital partners is not only reflected in college graduation statistics, it's also reflected in incarceration statistics. At the other extreme, 1 in 10 black men in their 20s, early 30s, more than 1 in 10, in fact, is in prison. Some estimates are that as many as 1 in 4 will go to prison. That's a reflection of, again, the fact that men are not faring as well educationally, and they're failing educationally at the same time that the labor market offers fewer opportunities than ever for blue-collar male workers. So men without an economic place in the society, perhaps unsurprisingly, end up in prison. So these are the developments that the book examines, the two chief ones. The decline in marriage throughout society, which is most pronounced among African Americans, and the changing economic positions of husbands and wives. And I'll say for the question, some of our evaluation, one of the tasks of the book is sort of to evaluate these outcomes. And are these things that we should be concerned about? Are they worrisome? Are they cause for celebration? What should our position be about these developments? So that's one issue. And the short answer is that these are things we should be concerned about. Otherwise, I wouldn't have written the book. But the other issue that arises is that part of the reason the situation is so much worse for African Americans has to do with interracial marriage. Or rather, the lack of interracial marriage, we should say, on the part of black women. Black women have the smallest pool of men within the group who are, shall we say, marriageable. You know, men who are stable, who are employed, who are able to be the sort of partners that anyone would want. Yet black women are also the least likely to marry outside of the group. Black men marry across group lines between 2 and 3 times as frequently as black women. About 1 in 5 black men will marry someone of a different race. This is when we look at recent marriages as opposed to all marriages. When we look at recent marriages, about 1 in 5 black men will marry someone of a different race, but fewer than 1 in 10 black women will do so. When we look at Asian Americans and Latinos, they're 3 or more times as likely to marry outside of their group as African Americans, or as black women in particular. So we have this disparity in rates of interracial marriage, which compounds the consequences of the gender gap among African American men and women. And the question, frankly, that pulled me through the book, right, the puzzle that I was trying to unravel throughout the writing of the book, was why is it that there are so few black men, yet there are so few black women who marry across group lines? Black women are more likely than any other minority group to marry someone of their own race when they do marry. That's a puzzle. And part of the book was devoted to trying to unravel that puzzle. And I'll reveal my hand a little here. The thesis that I developed in part of the book is that the continuing isolation of black women in the relationship market, which is a result of a whole constellation of factors, right? It's a whole constellation of factors. But that continuing isolation of black women in the relationship market actually means that they have fewer of the relationships that they want. They have fewer of the types of marriages that they want because there are too few partners available. And it also, in an ironic way, lowers the marriage rates of black men. One of the many puzzles, this is a whole series of puzzles, one of the puzzles is that, you know, although socioeconomic status is associated with marriage rates, and people who are again, men who are unemployed are less likely to marry than men who are employed, right? That might seem sensible. But when we look at African-American men, even men who are employed, men who earn a good income, men who earn $50,000 a year, $75,000 a year, even $100,000 a year, at every income level, black men are substantially less likely than white men to marry. And the question is, why is that? Part of the story about why that is because when, for a variety of reasons, we have black women confined to a relationship market with black men, that results in black men having a disproportionate amount of power in the relationship market. This is a situation where there's power in lack of numbers. Scarcity breeds power in the relationship market, because when one group is scarce, that group has more options and hence more leverage, more negotiating power. And if this sounds like a business transaction, in some ways it is, right? Love may be part of relationships. We may want to look into our beloved's eyes and find our, you know, gaze into their eyes and understand the depths of their soul and see ourselves reflected there. But relationships are also negotiations, and they also involve power. And one important source of power is the characteristics of the market. When you have too few men and lots of women, men have more power. And when men have more power, this is men of any race, they might be inclined to use that power to maintain relationships that are perhaps less committed, less marriage-like than the sorts of relationships the women might prefer. So, where the book ends, and I never know if I should give this away. No, I won't give it away. Forget it. So that's the issue. So there are 3 issues, right, that we could flag. One is the marriage decline. The other is the changing economic positions of husbands and wives. How do we assess those developments? What do they tell us about the future of marriage? And then the third is, why haven't black women followed other groups into an increasingly integrated marriage market? What's the constellation of reasons that keeps black women segregated, even as others, including black men, are increasingly integrated in their intimate relations? And part of the story there, I suggest, is that intermarriage might have a beneficial effect. This is giving away a little. Intermarriage might have a beneficial effect on the African-American marriage market, because if we can release all the pressures that we put on black women and allow black women to expand their options, they're expanding their options would also increase their power. And if they increase their power, black men and women would enter into relationships more on an equal footing. And that would actually be a beneficial development for African Americans. So I will stop there and we can take questions.
All right. Well, thank you. That was a very good introduction to your book. I had the distinct pleasure of reading the book this weekend, and I'll say that it's very good, and I highly recommend that if you haven't read this, that you pick this up and read it. What the professor does that I would say even brilliantly is interweaves this combination of statistics, I mean hard facts about the African-American population with these stories that emanate from interviews that you conducted over a couple of years, it sounds like, of over 100 African Americans. And so it's not just a dry recitation of facts. It's just very interesting how you set up a fact pattern, and then you'll back it up with these really compelling stories that emerge from your interviews. So buy the book and read it. It's just really a great read.
Let me just add the stories I should have came about by chance. When I started the book, it was much more of an academic book because I've written mostly academic articles. And then just by chance, I was talking to someone who was a Stanford grad, it turned out, African-American woman, and she was really interested in the book. And she kept asking me questions. And I said, well, why are you so interested in this? And she said, well, because it seems to relate to my life in ways that other things haven't. And then before you know it, we ended up having a very long conversation over several hours that became an interview. That was transformative both for me and for her. It was transformative for me because she illuminated things, even in that one conversation, that I hadn't thought about, but that actually I could see in the data. The idea about the change in economic positions of husbands and wives, for example, that was an issue that maybe the central issue that she grappled with in her own life. Yet she had never read about that, and I hadn't really read about it either because people haven't written much about that. But that's a hugely important issue. And after she highlighted it, I went back to the data, and I could see the evidence for it there. So that then reshaped the book. And the accumulation of interviews brought out aspects of people's lives that I never would have envisioned otherwise. And then it was useful for her because she was able to tell her story in a way she never had. And so then I set off and began to interview one person after another and hopefully have relayed faithfully their stories and reflections about their own lives.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Ralph Richard Banks, professor of law at Stanford University, who is discussing his book, Is Marriage for White People? How the African-American Marriage Decline Affects Everyone. I'm Stephen Falk, the city manager for Lafayette. So I will say that while reading the book, I think an essential question arose that I just have to ask, and it relates to this quote from black feminist Patricia Hill Collins, who wrote, and I quote, that freedom for black women has meant freedom from white men, not the freedom to choose white men as lovers, unquote. And yet here you are suggesting that African-American women need to consider marrying out both for their own self-interest and for the self-interest of the cohort of African-American women. So I've got to ask, you must be on book tours. Have you received, blowback from the black community about advocating that black women should consider marrying outside their race?
Okay, well, let me be very, very clear. This is as and my wife would urge me to, this is not an advice book. Yeah. I don't know enough about marriage to give advice, right? So this is not an advice book. I'm actually not urging anyone to do things. It's not my opinion, right? Because when you give advice, you give your opinion about what someone should do. The goal of the book, really, and the reason I embarked on it was to try to, it was really the intellectual goal, frankly, to try to understand what's going on. The core of this book is the research, the data, the evidence. It distills research from a variety of fields. I started with law and then soon moved to sociology, which in education and psychology, economics, history, which is sort of a background I had before law school. So I really want to present information to readers so that readers can understand, what's going on. How does the advance of technology shape people's intimate lives? Those are the sorts of questions I want to answer. So it's not an advice book. It's a book that hopes to provide information and understanding. At the same time, if there is a message, there is a message that we should reconsider all of the pressures and preferences and assumptions that have led to a situation where Black women are extraordinarily successful in many aspects of life, but where their relationships are much less integrated than the relationships of others. And part of that, I'll just say, is that I think that there's a stigma associated with interracial relationships. And that stigma is strongest when it comes to Black women. So this is a book that is focused on destigmatizing those relationships, not encouraging people to enter any particular relationship. But I do believe that Black women should have and should feel they have the very same options that people of other races take for granted. So Black women should have the same freedom to choose the partner that's best for them. And if that's an African-American man, fine. If it's a man of another race, that should be fine too, if they think that's the partner that's best for them. That statement actually has led to some controversy, but I stand behind that Black women should have the same freedom that people of other races do. They should not be disadvantaged by the fact that, Black men are not doing as well as they are.
I've got some questions from the audience here. First, a couple about the research. One person asks, how and over what period of time did you gather the data and research for the book? And I'm going to combine that with another question, which is, how did you find the women for your study to interview?
Okay, so I get depressed when I think about how long it took to write this book. I gave interviews to Stanford Law School publications in 2004. Saying that this project was well underway, because I had been thinking about it. Then I've taught family law for more than a decade. And one of the central issues in family law, of course, is how the American family is changing. So these were issues that were central to what I was teaching about. So I've been thinking about the issues for more than a decade. Began work about 10 years ago. Would work on it and then put it down and work on it and then put it down. Partly because it does bring together, I think, a lot of different types of research, and that was a difficult thing to do. Partly because I wanted to write a book that was both substantive, that I like to think you can learn something, if not on every page, and at least on every other page, but that was also engaging. So that was very difficult to do. So the research took many, many years, and the interviews took years as well. To select people to interview, I started off randomly by chance talking to one person And then she said, you know, you should talk to my friend so-and-so, and talk to a few more people. And then they had friends and talked to a few more people, and they had friends and talked to a few more people, and just explore different avenues. So I ended up talking to people. And it was mostly, initially I started out wanting to talk to women and men, frankly, mostly African-Americans, but women and men. But then I eventually shifted mostly to women because the women had a lot more to say about the issues. Just the men had very short answers. I hate to stereotype, but you know, there was one session in particular where I had a couple of groups. It was in Washington, D.C. I had two different sort of focus groups. And with the men, each interview was you know, 4 hours, say, four-hour conversations. But with the men, I felt like it was like pulling teeth to try to say, well, tell me more about that. Tell me more about that. Whereas the women seemingly began every answer with, I was just thinking about that, or I was talking to my girlfriend about that, or, you know, my mother and I were raising this issue, and they just had a lot to say. And then I realized the issues did resonate more deeply with women than with men. I also started with wanting to encompass the entire age range, so everyone from, you know, 20, you know, people who were in college and just out of college to people who were, you know, 60 years old, 70 years old. And eventually I realized that the people who were, you know, in their 30s, 40s, 50s had a lot more to say than the people who were 20 or 25, which frankly is just that, you know, the 25-year-olds were all looking forward, whereas the 35-year-olds or the 45-year-olds, you know, they're looking forward, but they're also looking back. And so the stories had a lot more depth to them because people were actually thinking about decisions they had made in their lives, right, and choices that maybe they didn't even see as a choice at the time. But in retrospect, they wonder, well, why did I do that? And they were sort of reconstructing their lives. And that was the part that was really rich for me. So the final product is weighted toward African-American women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. That's what it's weighted toward. And that's really those are the stories that come through most loudly.
So some of the statistics that you write about in the book, particularly regarding the disparate educational achievements of black men and black women, are just somewhere between surprising and stunning. Fewer than half of black men graduate from high school, and two black women graduate from college for every black man. I think I have that right.
That's correct. Yeah.
So one of our audience members asks, why do black women seek more education than black men?
Ooh, that's a big one. And I'll just say, as the parent of three young boys, this is the question I want the answer to. I don't have the answer yet. This actually is my next book, which is a prequel to this one, which is to say, you know, how can you have these, you know, African American boys and girls who are, by definition, are born into the same families? They're born into the same families. And then you look 18, 20, 22 years later, twice as many women as men graduate from college, right? And then for those, let me just say, for those sticklers out there, if anybody checks the stats, it's not literally twice as many. It's like 1.95 to 1. But we'll round that up, right? So it's about 2 to 1 in terms of college graduation. So how does that happen? And I think at this point I can just say it's complicated. I think there are a lot of factors. But that is the next book, is why do black boys fail? Which we can also think of as why do boys fail? Because it's also true that for any other group as well, we see there are more women than men graduating from college, right? So the situation with African Americans is a more extreme form of a trend that is a broader societal trend. So that deserves a book of its own. And in this book, I have a chapter on that, but it deserves a book of its own.
The next question I have, you, I think, just answered. What should be done to help black men in terms of education? And it sounds like that will be the conclusion to your next book. So, but I don't know if you have something you want to say about
that. No, that will. That, I mean, if I had the answer to that, I'd be at home implementing it right now.
Okay.
that is the question. And I should add, too, it's not, again, the puzzling aspect of that, right, is that this is not a class issue, right? A typical dialogue is that, you know, poor kids don't do well in school, and this is true, right? Poor kids don't do well in school, and children from affluent and highly educated families do better. And that, of course, is true. But when you're talking about the gender gap, that takes out that class issue. Because by definition, these children, boys and girls, are born into the same families. And even when you look at highly educated parents, you see there a gap between the performance of boys and girls. Most acute, most stark among African Americans, where the girls are more likely to go to college, more likely to get graduate degrees. The gender gap among African Americans in medical school and law school is approaching 2-to-1. It's not there yet, but it's approaching 2-to-1. There are more black women receiving medical degrees by a wide margin than black men, last year and this year coming. Same for law degrees. Every school in the country is aware of this, right? It's not limited to any particular area. It's a nationwide issue. And other groups are, they're trailing, but if history is a guide, they're moving in the same direction that African Americans are. So again, that is an issue that is that's the book I'll be working on whenever I'm not talking about this one.
Professor Banks, one area that you dive into in the book that is very interesting is this idea that African American women are more likely to marry down than to marry out. And you say that in black culture, or in many cultures, it's okay for men to choose partners of lower economic and intellectual status, but it's not always true for women. And the outcome typically is higher divorce rates and some tales of sheer misery that you describe in the book. This is part of the anecdotal portion. So I guess my question is that just the way it is, or is this sort of entrenched sexism at work, or is this an issue that could be improved over time through tolerance education?
Right. So one of the big issues is I talk about the sort of the fact that black women marry down, and this is just to say socioeconomically, I don't mean that pejoratively, black women marry men who are of lower socioeconomic status more than they marry men who are from a different racial group. And then the question is, well, what happens there? Mm-hmm. So what does the data show? This is a question I return to again and again and again. And we find among people generally relationships where the wife earns more of the money are more likely to be conflictual and more likely to lead to divorce. This is among everyone, among whites as well, right? More likely to lead to divorce. Now, I should say here, as a committed feminist, that long term, it should not matter who earns most of the money. In fact, I want my wife to earn a lot of money, right? And men are smart enough, ultimately, I think, to realize that this is a good thing if your wife earns a lot of money, right? So long term, it won't matter. But, and these are the stories in the book, right now, and for these people who were, 40 years old and were married, 10 years ago and got divorced, and they're looking back, it is the case that while gender roles have changed substantially, women can work, men can take care of children, one of the gender roles that has changed least of all is the expectation that men earn money, that men work. And if you have a situation where the woman is supporting the family because the man cannot, that is, in fact, likely to lead to some conflict. And in part, that will lead to conflict because the man may not be happy with that. And I have what I think are wonderful stories about this. A man may not be happy with that. But it may also lead to conflict, frankly, because the woman hasn't really adjusted her way of thinking as well. Because most women were not raised to think, at least not in my family, that their obligation was to support the family. Women were raised, at least in my family, to think that it was important to earn money in order to not be dependent on a man. You earn money so that you can be free. And that's very different from what we've told men their responsibility is as a breadwinner. Women earn money to be independent. Men earn money to fulfill a family responsibility. So when we have these different ideas in our heads, we have a situation where our ideas about the roles of men and women haven't kept pace with the economic changes on the ground. And we see that most starkly among African Americans because the gap between men and women is greatest, right? When we look at all African Americans across the board, black women earn about 95% of what men earn. But when we look at, you know, younger cohorts, that is, you know, people who are in marrying age and so forth, it's almost certainly the case that black women are out-earning black men, right? So black women are in the economic position of husbands traditionally, but our thinking hasn't shifted to take account of those changes. So yes, there are conflicts.
Mm-hmm. You've spent the last 7-10 years thinking about marriage, and it, just interestingly enough, this week was a very big week for marriage in California, given the Supreme Court decision to overturn Proposition 8. So I'd just like to hear your thoughts on the court's action. And also I've got a question from the audience about how do you explain the seeming rejection of same-sex marriage by the black community?
Right. Ooh, that's a big one there. Who snuck that in? So that with Prop 8, I think you're referring to the decision of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals affirm the district court judgment. This is a federal district court judgment invalidating Prop 8 as a violation of the federal constitution. The last word has not been spoken on that. I mean, the big question, of course, is what will the Supreme Court do, right? And there, it's hard to say. Some people, we should note, counsel the litigants not to pursue this case at all, because what some advocates of same-sex marriage did not want was for the Supreme Court to decide the issue, because they worried that if we force the Supreme Court to decide the issue, they will not decide it the way we want, and then we'll have a big roadblock to further change. So some advocates said, don't pursue litigation, yet on the other side, the public attitudes, which the Supreme Court always looks to, public attitudes about same-sex marriage and same-sex relationships have shifted unbelievably in the last decade. Just a little more than 10 years ago, it was permissible for a state to make it a crime for two men or two women to have a sexual relationship. And some states did. So we've come in just over a decade from a situation where it was illegal to even have a relationship to a situation where the Constitution might require the availability of same-sex marriage. That's a reflection of both the pace of legal change and also the pace of change with public opinion. So it's hard to say what the Supreme Court will do. Long term, I think we will have same-sex marriage be legal in more jurisdictions. That's for certain. That will be legal. I think African Americans are more likely than other groups to be opposed to same-sex marriage. This is not to say that African Americans turn the vote here or elsewhere, because African Americans are a small percentage of the voting population. But it is to say that when you have a group that's much more religious than the general population, which is the case, surveys show with African Americans are more likely to attend church regularly, more likely to believe in God, more likely to say God is an important part of their lives. They're more religious along a whole bunch of dimensions. And is that associated with opposition to same-sex marriage? Probably. So that would be the short explanation for that. Increased religiosity translates into less likelihood of support for same-sex marriage.
All right. This question says, what constraints do African-American women have to interracial marriage that other women don't? And I'll note that you write extensively about this in the book, and it may be the most interesting part of the book. It's real, just fascinating. And so when you answer this, I'm hoping you can both describe issues around hair and swag.
I don't think I can do justice to either of those. I might start reading, but I will say that my editor at Penguin Press, she always said that the interracial issues were the jelly in the donut. So why don't more black women marry men of other races? A whole host of reasons. So it's a puzzle. Lots of different pieces of the puzzle. One piece of the puzzle, you talk about hair. One piece of the puzzle there is that many black women worry that a white man in particular won't understand essential aspects of what it means to be them. And one place where this came up, much to my surprise, was in conversations regarding hair. Black women have a whole set of things that they do with their hair. And my wife is African-American. I don't understand them all now. So black women maybe justifiably worry that a non-black man won't understand all of these things that black women do with their hair. So there were lots of women. Again, this came up in one interview after another, which is the magic of the interviews, because I could see how people who didn't even know each other would raise similar issues, issues that might seem trivial, but they're actually emblematic of much broader issues. So the hair issue is the weariness and the awkwardness about having a discussion about how do you do your hair. Sometimes it starts with one couple. It started with the husband asking quite innocently, is something burning? And it turned out that his wife was doing her hair. And she did it with a hot comb that she heated on the stove. And then that, you know, led to a whole series of questions where this is a couple who's married, actually, this couple, and she, you know, even now she shakes her head and says, I don't know how I put up with that, because he was clueless, didn't understand anything. And that's just a small example of all the sorts of questions that people don't want to encounter, many of them having to do with race and how it is to be an African-American person in a mostly non-African-American society. And whether someone of another race can actually understand that in the way you want them to. And whether they'll have the empathy. It comes up in more serious context, you might think, where there was one woman who talked of the day the O.J. Simpson verdict was issued in the murder trial for Nicole Brown Simpson. And she was at her workplace. And this was in the Bay Area. She was at her workplace with a lot of whites, and she was the only black person there. And she reacted differently than the white people did at work. The white people at work were crestfallen, as she puts it, that, you know, he wasn't convicted. And they thought this was a travesty because it seemed obvious that he killed Nicole Brown Simpson and now he was going free. And this black woman had a much more complicated set of feelings about that whole issue. But she didn't feel that she could express that to any of her white coworkers. She didn't feel that they would understand it the way she did. And she also didn't feel that she could express that to her boyfriend, in fact. They'd gotten along great until this point, but he was white, and she didn't know if she could, and she didn't want to, frankly, have a conversation with him about what she felt about the O.J. Simpson verdict. So she delayed going home for hours. Mm-hmm. And then eventually did have the conversation. And as she put it, he was as empathetic and as understanding as any white person could be about how I felt. But there was still something missing for her, because he wasn't looking out at the world through the same lenses, if you will, that she was. And then this was a relationship that dissolved in part for that reason. So there are a whole host of concerns, legitimate concerns that people have about race.
This is the point where I've still got some written questions here, but if you'd like to ask a question personally and would like to come up to the microphone, feel free to do so. I will continue to work through the written questions if nobody comes up. So You also, just tailing on to that same point, you also, one of the really truly disturbing stories in the book was the story about the African-American woman who's was dating, married a white fellow, and his mother refused to meet her.
Oh, yeah, there are a lot of stories like
right,
that.
Right, exactly. Yeah. You know, so, I mean, there's a lot of barriers to entry to interracial marriage, I think.
Yeah, so
I was hoping you might talk about swag also, mm-hmm. Because I thought that was kind of an interesting.
Okay, well, on that, let me.
It's kind of the flip of the hair coin.
Okay, right. Well, yeah. So swag and then interracial. So I don't understand swag myself. Can I read a bit?
Yeah, please do.
I can read about swag. This is one of those issues that, again, I felt that a lot of this was about my entering into a world that I didn't really know about. And the swag issue is one place where that was especially true. So, for some women, for some women, black men are a habit they can't shake. One woman I interviewed had tried. Brothers had put her through so much, she explained, she wanted to give them up. Yet she recognizes, I've been on the black track so long, I don't know that I can get off. Her friends seemed more adamant. Black men been acting up, she says. I'm putting them on the bench. Still, she eventually found herself calling them back into the game. For many black women, the desire for black men begins with physical attraction. I don't do pale, one woman told me. No blonde hair, blue eyes for her. But a swarthy Mediterranean man? Well, she had married one of them. Still, she'd say, I'm not attracted to white men. She doesn't think of her husband as white. Another friend offered a different limitation. I can't do one of the ones with no upper lip, she said, pursing her lip as if to mimic what she found distasteful. These women erected no categorical bar against white men. They just didn't encounter many who made their skin tingle. As one woman told me, in a tone that she might have expected to end the conversation, I'm not attracted to white men. I couldn't take her at her word. Brad Pitt, I asked. Tom Cruise? George Clooney? I pressed for at least one exception. She kept shaking her head. John Travolta. Antonio Banderas, I offered, switching from the pretty boys to the gritty boys. And then my favorites. How about Nicolas Cage? Sean Penn? Tom Brady? No, no, no. The head kept shaking. There were no exceptions, black men only. She insisted that she never would, never could date any man who wasn't black. So what did these men lack that many black men had? Swag. The single-syllable answer I got from many women was an ineffable quality more easily felt than defined. Women know it when they see it. Will Smith has swag, but Brad Pitt does not. LeBron James has swag. Tom Brady does not. But swag is not limited to athletes and entertainers. Barack Obama has swag. George Bush does not. Although unquestionably associated with race, swag is not, strictly speaking, limited to black men, nor possessed by all black men. Bill Clinton has swag, but according to some women, at least Denzel Washington does not, unless he is in Training Day. While swag may seem to come naturally to black men, to white men it does not. One woman in Atlanta describes a common look among young white men. Dockers, khaki shorts, a colored polo shirt, Oakley sunglasses. Another woman calls it the frat boy look and acknowledges that such a look may count as a white guy's swagger, but it didn't do it for her. What then is swag? Many women associate it with confidence, brashness, bravado, charisma. It may begin with appearance, but it is also a matter of style and demeanor. A woman in D.C. says she met an Asian man she really liked, but then she realized he didn't have enough backbone. He was asking for permission for things and wasn't willing to take charge. Definitely not a man with swag. A man with swag leads rather than follows, and he's not afraid to let others know it. Swag embodies a model of black masculinity that, it seems, is part leader and part outlaw. The man with swag is one who sets his own agenda and refuses to abide by anyone else's. as much as I know.
You know, that's very good. And I'm sitting here thinking, wow, Professor Banks has swag and I don't.
No,
so,
no.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's just very clear.
I don't know. Here's one of my problems with this book. I don't write things that I like to read because I write law review articles, and I think it's true with most of my colleagues. When you write a law review article, you feel proud of it. You put it on the shelf, and maybe you refer to it. Maybe other people refer to it, but you don't take it to bed at night because it's just not that sort of writing. Whereas this, I take this book to bed frequently. So here's a local story. Even swag might not be enough if it doesn't come in the right color package. Carla, their human resources manager in Atlanta, recalls a relationship she couldn't bring herself to pursue with the man she describes as, quote, the hippest white boy I ever met. He was from Oakland. He was fly as all get out, she said, a cool-ass white boy. If you look up swag in the dictionary, you see his picture. Yet Carla waffled, as she put it, about whether to have a relationship with him, caught in what she describes as a crazy dilemma. Of all the reasons she had ever concocted to stay away from white men, that they wouldn't accept her, that they wouldn't be cool, that he had never been around black people, that he lacked swag, none of them applied. Her head said yes, but her heart said no. I couldn't do it, she reflects, frustrated with herself now for, as she put it, acting the fool. So,
very nice.
So there's why I like that. Yeah. But, So on the interracial issue, yeah. I mean, one of the things that I've shown in the book is that a lot of the issues that limit interracial couplings, again, they're not limited to African Americans, they're universal issues. One of the big factors is family pressure. Often people, if left to their own devices, would couple with people from other groups, right? They'd form relationships just based on mutual affinity. But families inhibit that process because families tend to want people to marry people like them. And that means people of the same race. And sometimes we see these pressures in a very stark fashion when you have black people and white people marrying, where, in one case, a young white girl, this is years ago, she was part of a church. Her father was the minister. The church emphasized interracial understanding and fellowship. When she went to a church retreat and met a black boy that she liked and then informed her father, he said, well, you took that idea a little too far. And it turned out other members of the congregation thought so as well. People left the congregation. They received threats. He almost lost his job, had to move to another city. She almost dropped out of college because then she was in college with this little black boy, and they didn't want her to be in college with him. Eventually, it all worked out. Now they've been married more than 40 years. They have grandchildren. But there were years where members of her family refused to acknowledge them as a couple. Their wedding was boycotted by some members of her family. So these pressures are pressures that emanate from all sides of the racial divide, so to speak.
All right. We're down to our last couple of minutes. So I've got one last question from the audience, and it is, what was the most unexpected thing you discovered while researching and writing this book?
Tricky. That's a tough one. I think one of the things I discovered, I mean, there's a lot, so I might give a different answer tomorrow. But one thing I discovered was that the problems with the situation where the wife earns more money than the husband, I'd always assumed that problem was about the man's sense of masculinity and the man being insecure and not being able to handle a woman who earned more than him or was more educated than he was. And that's part of the issue. But there is also a set of issues that have to do with the woman's frame of mind. And here's an example of that from the book. This refers to two different couples where the woman earned the bulk of the money. Cecilia, like other primary earning wives, operated on a model in which her earnings were secondary, additional income, what women of another era would have called mad money or pin money. This sensibility underlies both Cecilia's and Carla's expectation that their husbands should ask them for money and be thankful when they get it. Although each of these women earned substantially more than their husband, neither had a sense that their earnings went into one big pot from which either partner could freely draw. For each of these women, her money was just that, hers. Not his, not joint, but hers. They shared with their husbands to the extent that they chose, but they didn't feel obligated to do so. The idea of turning their money over to their spouse to manage, as many husbands have done when they earn the money, was unthinkable for these women. Had the roles been reversed and a higher-earning husband refused to freely share his income with his wife, he would have been roundly and rightly condemned as an oppressive patriarch. Yet Cecilia and Carla each thought that her approach was reasonable. And those are individual stories that are actually reflected in large-scale data. One of the findings that I talk about right after that in the book is a survey that looks at how spouses make decisions about money, and it looks at whether those decisions vary based on who's the primary earner. And in short, the finding of this survey was that when men earn most of the money, sometimes a man makes the decision about money, sometimes a woman makes the decision. Sometimes it's joint. It's about equally divided. The husband is no more likely than the woman to have final say. But when the woman earns the bulk of the money, that is, when the woman is the chief breadwinner, the woman is twice as likely as her spouse to have the final say about the money. I can't think of a clearer reflection, right, of the idea that when the woman earns the bulk of the money, they're more likely to think of that money as, well, this is her money. Whereas when the husband earns the bulk of the money, you know, he's doing so to support the family. The money is part of a big pot. So that's an issue that surprised me. But on reflection, it should be surprising because it shows, again, that this expectation that men contribute economically is really deeply entrenched. And men are still understood to be the breadwinners. Women are still understood to work for fulfillment, for independence, for other goals, rather than simply to fulfill an obligation to their family.
Very good, Professor Banks. That will conclude our interview this evening. Our thanks to Professor Ralph Richard Banks for his remarks here tonight. He's agreed to stick around for a few minutes and sign books and answer any questions you might have. We'd like to thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and internet. I'm Stephen Falk. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you very much.